I needed to not skate by for once in my life, and they didn't let me.
At the end of the day, if you know that you don't feel good about the job, you got to be able to leave that behind.
They just kept asking me to come back, and I truly love Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin.
It's always great to be at WTMJ.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins. In 2008, Mark Jensen was sentenced to life in prison without parole for the poisoning murder of his wife, Julie. That verdict was overturned, and a second trial took place, resulting in a second conviction. Joining us today is Ken Humphrey. He was the foreman of that second jury. He's also operations director for the Wisconsin Writers Association. He's co-host of the Midwest Writers Room, and he also has written a book. It's called The Breakfast Jury. It's a novel, and it has some elements of the Jensen case. And I got to ask you, first of all, Ken, how were you selected for a jury?
It was a day and a half process. I mean, there were at least 100 prospective jurors, and we were informed that the trial was expected to last at least 4 weeks, and that the administrative staff at the court expected a lot of dropouts. So that's why they had a large jury pool. But it went through the normal selection process where, you know, you fill out your questionnaire, they ask if anybody has a problem, you know, serving on the jury, which took the majority of the time, because once they heard a 4 week estimation of the length, a lot of hands went up and said, I can't be able to work that long, which really cut down the jury pool. But then it followed on that they had some questions. They asked me a little bit about what my occupation was. They asked people how they felt about certain things from a legal standpoint.
Like, such as?
Has anybody ever been arrested for violence or domestic abuse? Has anybody ever used this specific firm for their financial investments?
Yeah.
It's kind of hinting around as to what prospective jurors, which way they would lean, right? In your typical jury selection, you know, the prosecution wants somebody who would lean towards the prosecution side. Defense is trying to weed out those people and get people favorable to their client. So there were a number of those questions that went through the jury, but it was really limited because you had still a lot of people left and they had about one question each for the people, right? That was about all the time that they had. So that's one simple clarifying question, and they move on to the next prospective juror.
Did you have any inkling at the time what the case was going to be about?
It's funny, no. I had heard about a case back in, you know, the 2000s, whatever, in the Kenosha News, about a man who poisoned his wife with antifreeze. And then when they introed us in the jury selection and said, well, this is a case for Mark Jensen, who was accused of, you know, poisoning his wife with antifreeze, the first thought in my mind was, wait, there was another one? I didn't realize it was the same case coming back around. I didn't really pay attention to local news. My wife knew, right? She is dialed into all that, so she knew, but she wouldn't tell me anything about it, lean into it. She knew I was going to be up for that case because she had seen it on the docket leading into my initial selection day. But for me, I was like, oh, a guy poisoned his wife with antifreeze. There's more of these people around?
So at what point did you find out you're on the jury?
The second day, you know, they sent us back over lunch, and then after lunch, they said, okay, we're going to call out your jury number. Please come gather out in the hall. And so they called out 16 numbers, and we sit around looking, all of a sudden we realized, wait, I guess we're the jury. You know, at that point, there's nothing really official until one of the bailiffs finally joined up with us and said, okay, you guys are our jury. Follow me.
What was the makeup?
It was pretty much split male, female, and the ages. We had a girl who was probably in her early 20s all the way to several retired people. So it was a very widespread demographic. People working professional jobs, white collar, people working some blue collar jobs. And like I said, there were probably 3, 4, or 5 people that were retired from various occupations. So we were pretty well spread across.
How did you feel about the people you just now realized I'm going to spend the next 4 weeks or more with?
It was a rather eye-opening experience. And I know we're going to talk about it later when we talk about my book, but it was something that I would not have actually foreseen the way things played out. My thought going in is, all right, you know, I've got 15 other strangers here. Who am I going to get along with? Who's going to be the instigator, right? Who's going to be the person that's going to be the rule follower? Who's going to be the one that says, ah, you know what, let's just vote and be done with it, right? So I was just kind of looking at it more from a personality breakdown, listening to people, chatting with them, trying to figure out where they fit, what their personality profile might be.
What did you judge yourself to be in terms of the profile of yourself, if you were looking from the outside in?
I would class myself as somebody who was very vested in the actual process. So in other words, it wasn't, all right, let's just get down and get everything done so we can go you know, vote on a verdict and go home. I was more, okay, what is the process that we're going through and how do we make sure we do it right? Because regardless of any preconceived notions going in, it did not fail to strike me that we were judging the fate of a man, right, at the end of it all. So I wanted to make sure that I was going to be very true to the process and pay attention, right? I didn't want to be the guy staring off into space in the jury pool during all the testimony. I want to make sure I took good notes. So I would class myself as very much more the adherent to the process.
Had you ever been in a courtroom before?
Never on a jury. When I was younger, I used to catch shoplifters for a living during college. And so
That was your job?
That was my job. Yeah, catching shoplifters. And that required a number of times where I would actually have to show up for a trial. If they contested the charges, I would show up as a witness. And so I wasn't unused to some of the pomp and circumstance of a courtroom. But again, it always had been as a witness where I'd show up, say my piece, you know, kind of barter with the lawyers, deal with the lawyers, and then leave. It was never the full gamut from beginning to end.
You did not find this intimidating then, your first day in there?
I wouldn't say intimidating. I was probably more curious, more interested in just kind of how everything is going to play out, right? We've all watched things like Law and Order. We've read our John Grisham books and that to kind of get a vague idea of how court or trials are run. But I was more curious to say, okay, how is this really going to be run? Is it going to stand true to what we see on TV and in movies, right? I was very interested in kind of the comparison of real life versus what's been fictionalized.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He would just stare at the jury. All of us jurors agreed it was very unnerving.
Ken Humphrey, jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial, talks about whether or not a jury makes up their mind during opening arguments.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with Ken Humphrey. He was the jury foreman for the second Mark Jensen trial. So what happened day one?
Day one is when they kind of introduced all the charges and talked about it. The lawyers gave their opening statement. And the prosecutor actually had come back. He no longer was a DA for Kenosha County, but he had come back for this. This was his case originally. And I don't know if it was a matter of him wanting to be able to close it out when the trial came back around, but he had come back from his new occupation to serve as special prosecutor on this. You could tell he was very invested in proving the state's case, right? And he was very theatrical about it. You know, he'd kind of be up there and waving his arms and almost performing, let's put it that way. And the defense obviously provides their vantage. And I do remember thinking that the prosecution, their opening statements lasted a long time because they had all this evidence. They're talking about all the expert testimony, digital testimony that they had written, all this. And I'm like, wow, they got a lot they're bringing to bear. And the defense essentially came up there and said, well, no, she was depressed and took her own life and we'll prove it. At that time, I remember thinking, that's what they got? Okay. Let's see.
Well, academic psychologists say something like 65 to 75% of jurors make up their minds during opening statements.
I could believe that.
Do you think that's the position you were in and most of the other members of that jury?
I remember coming out of the opening thinking, okay, the defense has got their work cut out for them. If this is all they brought to their opening argument, they've got their work cut out for him to show that it truly was intentional on her part, that it was not homicide, but a suicide. So I hadn't made up my mind, but I was just probably more surprised at the defense's posture in this when they opened during their arguments.
What was your impression of Mark Jensen the first time you saw him?
Cool. He just sat there, quiet. Obviously, you know, they don't speak, but I do remember being a little weirded out by him.
In what way?
Because of the way he would just stare at the jury. And this was something
He stared at you guys?
Oh, yeah. All of us jurors agreed it was very unnerving during the selection process and then essentially the first day of trial. We were being looked at like we were some type of zoo exhibit. The way the lawyers would sit and study us during selection as we were being asked questions, during opening arguments, the way the other counsel that wasn't talking, how they would sit and study us along with Mark Jensen. And then as soon as the prosecution sat down and the defense started talking, then the prosecution's doing the same thing, just staring at us like we're mannequins behind this window. It felt really weird, right? And him, the way he stared, just kind of added to it, right? He's just doing the same as his lawyers, but it just added to this oddity of, I feel like I'm on display.
Did any of the jurors react during this time when people would be staring at them? Did they stare back? Did they make funny faces?
No funny faces that I saw, some staring back, but I think most everybody just sat and focused on whoever was talking. the judge giving us instructions, one of the lawyers, but just kind of kept our eyes focused on that and tried not to look too often to the gallery where there were reporters filling all the rows, cameras clicking, not at us, but, you know, of the courtroom overall, and just trying not to look too much in that direction because that became a little unnerving as well. It's like, man, there's 100 people sitting here watching opening arguments, right? And they're all staring at us.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
Everybody sat in the same spot in the jury room. So you started getting to know the people around you. And we just had these habits and patterns that we fell into.
The jury foreman for the second Mark Jensen trial, Ken Humphrey, talks about some of the different personalities that made up the jury.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Ken Humphrey. He was the jury foreman for the second Mark Jensen trial. So as the trial progressed, what were your feelings? How did you start to feel as you heard more details of that case?
I started feeling like we would be able to come to a verdict in a defensible manner. In other words, they're putting up a lot of evidence, and we'll be able to use that evidence in terms of our verdict. You know, this isn't going to be something where it's all hearsay or it's all just witness testimony, right? There's physical evidence, there's photos, there's audio evidence. I said, okay, this is going to help us really make a good defensible verdict. Because that was my big thing coming in is regardless of which way it goes, we want to be able to defend the decision that we made. And so as the days progressed, the amount of testimony, the amount of evidence they're producing made me feel, okay, we'll be able to rely on that.
How did your fellow jurors react? Did people begin to get fatigued? Did you find that they were just, let's get this over with? Or
by week two, it was already, it's not so much let's get this over with. It's, all right, what are we going to do to get us through the day? So we started, all right, who's bringing breakfast? I was surrounded by a bunch of people who thought a lot about food. Maybe I don't think about food as much as they did, but they're talking about food and where to eat lunch. And so we started this breakfast ritual of bringing in different pastries from around the area. And we kind of came into this pattern where everybody sat in the same spot in the jury room. So you started getting to know the people around you. And we just had these habits and patterns that we fell into. Some people were just taking note after note after note. We had one girl in the jury who, I bet you she went through a dozen notebooks. She became our stenographer, really, because she was so good at capturing all the details. Whereas another person kind of sat there. Like, he didn't take his notebook in. He's like, I just want to sit and remember and not take down notes that might kind of slant or tilt my opinion either way. So he would just sit and stare and watch the proceedings. Early on, like, wow, is this really going to go 4 weeks? Someone would tick off, like, oh, we've only seen 10 witnesses. We got, you know, 80 to go. Like, oh. So there is a little bit of, I wouldn't say fatigue, but just kind of maybe dread or the opposite of whatever anticipation is.
You weren't sequestered, so you went home every night.
We went home every night.
How difficult was it to avoid reading or seeing anything about the trial or avoiding questions from your friends, family saying, so how's the trial going, Ken?
It took effort. I will say that. I'm a digital person. I'm online. So, yes, one, it was a concerted effort not to accidentally bump onto Kenosha News and read an article or over on YouTube, you know, because I knew they were recording and showing this. My wife would watch it throughout the day, but she would never tell me anything about what she saw.
This was on Court TV?
Yeah. Several other outlets were also broadcasting it. When we'd leave the room because the lawyers had an argument or something, you know, she would never tell me what happened. She would never reveal anything that happened throughout the day. So it was a concerted effort. And absolutely, anytime I ran across a new set of friends or relatives, like, oh, I heard you're on that case. What's going on? Just going through the stuff, going through witnesses. That's all, right? And just try and keep it very neutral and not talk about it.
Were any of the jurors removed during the trial?
No. The original 16, we went all the way through.
And without going into the details of the case, because it was a man who was accused of poisoning his wife with antifreeze, after all of the evidence was presented and they had closing arguments, let's move to that. Mm-hmm. What was your impression of the prosecution and the defense during closing arguments?
It really was a magnified version of what I thought coming out of opening arguments. And the prosecution had this mountain of different types of evidence, but the special prosecutor was really hamming it all up, right? And during closing arguments, you know, he just dialed it up to 10 and used a completely different voice and spoke very softly. And he's kind of acting. He's presenting this closing argument, but you could tell it was an act. And the defense, you know, kind of the same thing, is she wasn't playing it up as much, but she essentially came back with the same line of defense as, well, nope, this was a suicide, and here's our evidence towards that, which I just thought wasn't as great as the prosecution's evidence.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
It's not that I think he is not guilty based on the evidence. It's just, do we have enough to show that he is guilty? This is a man's life we're talking about.
Ken Humphrey, the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial, talks about the jury's deliberation.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Ken Humphrey. He was the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial. So now the judge says, jury, it's time for you to make a decision. You go into that jury room.
Mm-hmm.
How did that come about? Because you were appointed foreman.
Mm-hmm.
How did that all happen?
I think anybody who served on jury would probably recognize this. As you go back, and some people are like, I absolutely don't want to be foreman. And some people are like, well, I think I should be foreman, right? And then you get some people kind of in the middle. And nobody wanted to broach the subject at first. We walked back there, and, you know, we had some leftover lunch. We're kind of nibbling on that and chatting. Someone's like, well, we should probably pick a foreman.
It was that
broke
casual?
The water. Yeah, it was that casual. And I would suspect this probably happens more often than not during juries, that somebody finds like, hey, we got to pick a foreman. Let's do it. And a couple of people were like, well, I can do it if nobody else wants to, right? That's kind of that, I think I want to be a foreman, but if somebody else really wants it more, fine. And one of the other jurors like, well, I think Ken should be the foreman. And he's like, anybody else? People raised their hand. And I looked around and said, well, okay, I guess I'm the foreman. I mean, there's nothing formal. We thought the judge would give us instructions like, here's the best way to pick your foreman. You should have these characteristics, blah, blah, blah. Nope. And the judge just said, all right, we're going to go back. You pick your foreman and you begin deliberation. And so there's kind of this walking back with this wide-eyed look on our faces like, that's it. We're on our own. We're just making this up as we go.
So when you sat down to deliberate, nobody really told you how to go about a deliberation?
Nope.
You wrote the script, basically.
Yep. There's no template, no process, no suggestion of how we should approach it. And maybe that's by design. I don't know. But yeah, we walked in there just blank slates.
So what did you do? You're in charge now.
Yep. It's like, all right, let's just take a preliminary vote. Everybody, right? Take a piece of paper off your notepad, write, you know, guilty, not guilty, crumple it up and put it in this basket, and let's just go through and see what we had, right? That was essentially our first official act as a jury. And we had four people that had voted not guilty. I should say at this point in time, our jury was cut down to 12 because we had four alternates. And so they were sent to a completely separate room in case one of us could not fulfill our jury duty. So we're down to 12. I feel really bad for those four people who sat there for 4 weeks and didn't even get to vote on the verdict. That's kind of brutal. But we sat down and said, okay, we had four people who voted not guilty.
Did you kind of know who the four were?
It didn't surprise me, the four that were not guilty, just kind of by the questions they had asked and the things that they had said. And one of them put it succinctly, and I don't think she was speaking for the other three, but she kind of captured it saying, it's not that I think he is not guilty based on the evidence. It's just, do we have enough to show that he is guilty? This is a man's life we're talking about, right? And she was very compassionate, empathetic. I think she was struggling with that even though she thought there's plenty of evidence, was it enough for her? Could she go to bed at night based on the evidence we had if she had said guilty? And I think the way the other three reacted is a very similar mindset. It's like, yeah, we got to make sure we have enough evidence to say guilty.
So how long did you deliberate?
It was spread across 2 days. I think it was a total of about 8 hours. We only had an afternoon, and our judge was very much, we're out by 5. I have dogs to feed, so we will never go past 5 o'clock. And so we deliberated on the first day just for a couple hours. And then the bailiff said, it's 5 o'clock. And I don't know that any of us slept that night. Because the first day was really getting to that initial vote and then just starting to say, okay, what evidence are we going to use, right? How do we want to kind of work through this process? And as foreman, a lot of that ends up on you to say, okay, they're looking and saying, lead us. What are we going to do? And so we just kind of wrangled initially for the first couple hours on, okay, here's the evidence. Here's kind of how we're going to go through this. Let's look at it from timeline standpoint. Let's look at it from testimony and just kind of laying the groundwork. Before we actually started debating amongst ourselves, it was kind of, this is the groundwork.
How did the discussion go? Did people get emotional?
I wouldn't say overly emotional. We didn't get the point where we were barking over each other or yelling at each other. I mean, we had a few moments where everybody's talking at once, But, you know, it'd be one of these where they split and three people are talking and two other people are talking and nobody can hear anything. But there wasn't any confrontation, let's put it that way. So I wouldn't say we got emotional as much as everybody wanted to make sure that they had their viewpoint heard. And that was important to me, to make sure that nobody just sitting back and nodding because it's the easy way out.
As we said, you took an initial vote. Did you take another vote before you took the final vote?
Here's what happened. When we came back the next day, I had encountered some very contrary opinions on the first day of testimony. You know, a couple of people voted no or even had voted guilty, threw up some different scenarios. Like, what if this happened? How would we do this? And so I'm like, all right, how do I essentially address and overcome those arguments without making them feel like we're just telling them to say guilty or not guilty? How do I address it so they come to their own verdict? And we went through that and we ended up stripping away a good amount of the evidence, said, okay, you can throw up objections to all these things, but let's get it down to the core thing, like the timeline or the forensic evidence. If you present this objection, does that change any of this evidence, right? Does any of this evidence make you change your mind on that objection? We had probably five or six key pieces of evidence that we were relying on amongst everything that we had seen. And we kept going back to that when people's like, well, what about this? It's like, let's look at these five pieces. Does that change anything about these five pieces? So then on the second day, yes, we ended up taking another vote. It was actually one of the jurors, the one who was getting a little emotional about the verdict, you know, about her ability to live with the verdict that she provided. She looked at me at one point, she's like, I think she'd take another vote. And so we did. A couple of the people that originally had voted not guilty had come off that vote either the first day or early in the second day.
Did they say why they changed their mind?
I think it was really because of the focus that we had on the evidence to say, you said this was your objection yesterday. When you get down and look at the evidence, do you still see it that way? And so both were like, no, you're right. I'm good now. And so it was really down just a couple people left who we weren't certain if they were still holding to their not guilty vote, if they're ready to change their mind, or you know, even where they stood, because they weren't really voicing that. And that's why it's like, all right, let's take another vote. And then at that point, everybody voted guilty.
What was the emotion in the room when you came up with a guilty verdict and everybody realized this is this man's life?
I mean, it may sound a little callous at first, but it was relief. We got to a verdict. And I said it quite a bit during the deliberations. Whatever we deliver as a verdict, it has to be defensible. In other words, if somebody were to come to you and say, why? Why did you guys vote guilty? We have to be able to defend that, either individually as a group. And so I think when we got to that point, everybody understood, yep, it's a defensible verdict, right? It's one that's made in the correct manner. And so all that left was relief, room for relief. There may have been some who were like, all right, well, we just sentenced a man back to life in prison. But for the most part, it was just, all right, we've got a verdict. Now what do we do?
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
He just sort of looked across the rest of the jury. There wasn't any type of emotional display.
Ken Humphrey, the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial, talks about walking into the courtroom and looking into the eyes of the man they just convicted.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back to our conversation with Ken Humphrey. He was the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial, and he's also an author who's written a book called The Breakfast Jury. Now you go back into the courtroom, and as you're walking in, you said before that everybody was kind of looking at you like exhibits in a zoo. Mm-hmm. You must have really felt all eyes upon you.
It was, because during the course of the trial, the gallery had thinned out. There's interest on the opening arguments, a lot of reporters, a lot of photographers, and then over the course of the 4 weeks, they fade out. But on the last 2 days, when we walked back into that courtroom, it was wall-to-wall, packed. I remember glancing over, because when you walk in, you're walking past the judge's bench, so you're seeing the entire gallery, you're seeing both the legal tables in front of you, so you're essentially facing everybody as you walk in over to your jury box. And I remember glancing, because I didn't want to make eye contact with anybody. I didn't want anybody to catch me looking at them. But I remember just like, there are people everywhere in here. I'm like, there's not enough seats. There are people standing in the aisle. There are people lined up along the back. And I was carrying the verdict paper. I'm like, I don't want anybody to know I'm the foreman. Not that I was trying to hide. I'm like, I feel like I don't want anybody to know I'm the foreman yet. And if they recognize I'm carrying the paper, then they're all going to be staring at me as the judge talks through his thing, waiting to receive the verdict. We were very solemn going in. Normally, we'd walk in, we'd kind of be making little jokes or commentary to each other in the hallway. leading to the courtroom. This time, dead silence, utter silence amongst us walking down the hallway, making our trek and entering the courtroom. Because I think everybody understood, all right, this is it. You know, we've delivered this verdict, and there are a lot of people staring at us.
When the verdict was announced, who were you looking at?
I was actually looking at Mark Jensen, and he didn't really react. He just sort of looked across the rest of the jury. Same with the defense lawyers, right? They were all just stood there, and they had pretty stoic looks on their faces. So there wasn't any type of emotional display to react to. We had the verdict, and then the judge moved right on to the administrative part of it.
And then the judge said, thank you for your service. Yes. You're free to go.
Yes.
And then your phone started ringing.
Leaving the courtroom, they let us out kind of the back hallway because it was packed out in the main lobby. There was, I don't know if it's Court TV, I don't know if it's ABC, whoever. Myself and a couple of the people were some of the first ones to leave, and they're right there. They've got their camera set up outside the exit door. Like, they knew. They knew that we were going to be let out a different door in the main hallway. And so they had cameras set up and people standing with mics, and it's like, do you care to make comment? Care to make comment? And we'd all agreed as a jury, judge says we're free to talk about this as much as we want now that it's over. I said, I don't know about you guys, but I'm not going to do any interviews about it initially. We'd all agreed, okay, just kind of a no comment. Let things settle, right? Don't go running to ABC right away, or don't go picking up the phone, because I did receive a call from ABC before I got home.
So within what, a half an hour, an hour?
There's a few hours. You know,
you given them your phone number?
No. And they called my cell phone. I saw this Chicago number come up, and I was already at home at this point. Now I'm going on Twitter. I'm going on YouTube. Now I can go look at everything that I missed, right, to see what happened. And so I was actually on Twitter, and my phone rang, and I answered it. And they're like, this is ABC 2020, da-da-da. And I'm like, oh, huh, how'd you guys get my number? Right? And I just said, no comment, and I hung up. And as I was scrolling through Twitter, all of a sudden I come across a picture, and it's a picture of the verdict statement with my signature on it. Like, they had blacked out my actual signature, but I could see my handwriting. That made it out there fast. Like, somebody in the courtroom had to have taken a picture of it. Somebody who actually held this piece of paper. I don't know where it goes from the bailiff and the judge, but somebody said, let's take this picture and post it.
So now your life is back to normal.
Life is back to normal.
But you're a writer.
I am a writer.
When did you decide to write a book about a jury?
So the jury had found out I was a writer a couple weeks into it. You know, I just talking to people, and what do you do, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, you absolutely need to write a book about this. I said, well, you know, A, I'm a fiction writer, right? I don't do nonfiction. And jury tell-alls have been done to death. Anybody in a big trial, it seems like there's one person that has a tell-all book that comes out. And frankly, I'm like, they're just done to death, right? I didn't really have any interest. But what really sparked it was when I started watching the dynamic of us in the jury room. I would assume most juries, they're together for a few days. You have this compressed sense of, we get to know each other, we go through the whole court process, we deliver a verdict, and then we all go our separate ways. When you're 4 weeks of 5 days a week, 8 to 5, together with the same people, all sitting in the same spot in the room, and all going through this together, it created this, what I call the breakfast club scenario. Five high school kids got thrown together, and they were nothing alike, and they found out they had a lot of things in common. It was not that much different for us. People that I would never have come across in my normal walks of life, I came across in that jury room, and we all actually became friends. I would not hesitate to call any of them my friends at this point in time, and I think a lot of them feel the same.
Have you stayed in contact?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we've gotten together. We had an official reunion back in February, right on the day of the one-year anniversary. I had given another podcast speech, and one of the jurors came to my house as a second person. And the podcast, we've gotten lunch with a couple of people together. So we've gotten together a couple times as a group, and then some other people have kind of split and done things individually.
But now your book, mm-hmm. The Breakfast Jury, it's out there now. It's been published. It's available. How much of it is based on personal experience and how much of it is fiction? If you had to break it down percentage-wise.
I will say probably 40% is real from the actual trial. So in the book, the scenes that happened in the courtroom, the things that are said, those are all right from reality. I may have combined things, you know, between two witnesses and what they said. I might have altered the order of some of the things, but they're all directly from what we had observed and went through. The fictionalized part really is the other layer of the story, where it's an investigation piece. That's where I fictionalized it all. But yeah, the courtroom stuff, I wish I'd kept my notebooks. That would have been very handy.
Right? Would you have been allowed to do that?
No. No, they told us we could not take them. But our stenographer was very, very distraught that she did not sneak her notebooks out because she had a stack of them and she loved those things.
I'm kind of curious about this because obviously this was Jensen's second trial. Mm-hmm. First verdict had been overturned. Are you now, or at any point when you were writing The Breakfast Jury, did you start to think, wait a minute, I was the jury foreman. This is kind of based on the experience. Could this come back at a later date where somebody's going to try once again to overturn the verdict that we made against Mark Jensen because of what I've written in this book?
So that actually was very much a concern of mine before I even started. And like I drafted what the book would be about, but I actually consulted with a couple different lawyers that specialize or are familiar in the literary realm. And I said, here's what I want to do. Where can I get in trouble? Right? What should I avoid? So one of the things I did was I fictionalized all the names for everybody in there. And I took care to really walk wide of any defamation labels, because that's really where you run into danger territories. If you defame somebody, if you say something about them that they did, that, you know, smirched their reputation, whatever, and wasn't true, right? That's where you could really get yourself in trouble. And so that's why I really stuck to the courtroom facts of what went on, because that right there is public record. Right? And you can read the transcripts if you so desire. And so I tried to keep myself safe within that to say, okay, I'm just repeating or I'm just rewriting what actually happened. I'm not giving an opinion. I'm not making statements on anybody that participated in it that portrays them in a defamatory light.
Looking back, are you genuinely pleased that you were part of that jury and the process?
Absolutely. The term life-changing or life-altering events gets thrown out quite a bit, right? It can be used pretty loosely. You know, and I want to keep it in context. This isn't necessarily a life-changing event for me.
It certainly is for Mark Jensen.
It was for Mark Jensen. But it was a tipping point for me because A, it opened my eyes to something I never had experienced with before. And B, it kind of opened this avenue, writing a book in this genre and then taking that and seeing where it leads me. So yeah, it definitely had a significant impact. And yes, I am glad I went through it. It was all said and done.
Still ahead on WTMJ Conversations.
North in the Midwest kind of has a certain flavor to them.
Ken Humphrey wasn't just the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial. He's also a professional writer who helps coach other writers.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Ken Humphrey, who not only was the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial, he also is a professional writer. Ken, I want to ask you about the Wisconsin Writers Association as well as your Midwest Writers Room podcast. Tell us about the organization. What do you do?
So Wisconsin Writers Association is a volunteer organization for writers, predominantly in Wisconsin, but we have them throughout the U.S. And it's really a organization designed to support writers, help them improve their craft, help them network amongst other writers or industry professionals with the ultimate goal of achieving whatever their writing target is, whether they want to write novels, whether they want to do poetry, fiction, whatnot. And so we try to provide resources towards that, right? Whether it's workshops, annual conferences. The Midwest Writers Room podcast is something that started within the last year, which is another vehicle to kind of further that goal. And that podcast really focuses on that Midwest type writer, right? There's a writer in the Midwest, and often in the Midwest, kind of has a certain flavor to them, right? And I've kind of mentioned it before, I've phrased it before, somebody who lives in the Midwest, grows up in the Midwest, knows what the sound of corn is like in early July, right? They know what it's like to walk down this dusty field and hear cows in the distance. And so a lot of your Wisconsin writers, a lot of your Midwestern writers draw on those types of themes. And so that's a lot of what we target is that type of writing. And again, bringing in authors that, you know, are folks in the Midwest and talking about how they write. In other words, not just what books do you have out, but what's your thought process? What's your routine? What tools do you use? How do you find inspiration? So the Midwest Writers Room is a podcast sponsored by the Wisconsin Writers Association that, again, goes in furtherance of just helping authors and writers of all types develop their craft.
The Breakfast Jury isn't your first book.
It is not. It is the ninth book.
Hopefully it's not going to be your last.
It is not. Although I am taking a break. I mean, I wrote the book in about 10 months, and that can be a bit of a grind.
Will you continue to write fiction?
Oh, yeah. That's about all I write. I don't really, I'm not very good at poetry.
Does your experience want you to write more things about criminal cases?
A number of my previous fiction books were already kind of in that murder mystery genre. I have a trilogy that is already in that murder mystery genre. So absolutely, I would probably say that's my core genre that I write in. And I've got a couple of books queued up. You know, I've already done the research, done my character study, all that, and you laid out the plot, that are probably more in that murder mystery or thriller genre. So yes, the next book I put out will likely be some type of legal thriller.
We've been talking with Ken Humphrey. He was the jury foreman for the Mark Jensen trial. He's also written a book, not about that trial, but certainly inspired by it, called The Breakfast Jury. Now, if you've joined us late and you want to hear our entire conversation with Ken, go to WTMJ.com and share today's show with your friends and family. You'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.